Anyway, here we are. And theme for tonight and this month is wise speech or right speech. And this is such a juicy topic. Speaking with Suze just briefly before we started, and we could do a year really on speech, right? It's so much a part of how we are in the world. That's like the core of our relational engagement. It's so powerful. So I'll offer just a few reflections on it tonight. I wanted to start with this quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. He says, "First, we have to understand that speaking is action. When we say something, that speech will have an effect on our body, on our mind, and on the world. Good speech will give us joy and health, physical and moral health, and it will change the world in the direction of goodness. We should practice right speech, which inspires understanding, joy, hope, solidarity, brotherhood, and sisterhood. Your speech is the seed, it is the cause. And what it produces in you and in the world is the kammapala, the karma fruit. Action as cause and action as fruit. Sometimes action fruit manifests immediately after the action cause. Sometimes it takes months or years before it leads to a result. But sooner or later, the cause must become an effect." So this year we've been exploring the Four Noble Truths. So the heart of the Buddha's teaching, and really think of it as like the medicine, in which the Buddha offered a response to the experience of human suffering. So he spoke to its cause. He spoke to the possibility of its ending, and he spoke about the path to its ending and what elements or what factors of a whole life path, an integrated path, what factors would a whole life path entail or encompass? So that's the Eightfold Path. And this is the path that leads to the end of suffering. This is the path that we live out in everyday life. And it has these three kind of sections that we've been exploring. So the first section has to do with wisdom, has to do with our view and intention, our orientation and our direction. The second part has to do with our ethics, with our action in the world, with how we are in the world. So we're just starting this section on ethical action. And the third aspect has to do with our meditation and our concentration and our effort. So the whole Eightfold Path is meant to be a deepening spiral, right? It's not a straight line. Like all good maps, it's a deepening spiral. So we're in this middle part, in which speech, action, and livelihood are the factors that make up, our kind of ethical sensitivity and engagement. So how we are in the world. So if our view is aligned with the Dhamma, yeah, which means that if we're concerned more and more with this experience of suffering and its end, then how do I relate to other people? Yeah. How do I speak to my child or my employer? What do I tweet or text or post or write? Yeah. How do I contribute? So how do my actions change? How does what I speak, how I act, how does that change based on a different understanding or approach? Right. So speech is one of our most powerful forms of action, like Thich Nhat Hanh was saying. It can be used like a weapon. Many of us have likely experienced some version of this. It can be used to incite violence. It can cause harm. It can destroy in countless ways. It can also uplift. So speech can encourage, it can unify, it can clarify, it can uplift. It has a particular potency and power to elucidate what's true. We can say, when we say, we're able to speak clearly, directly, and kindly. That has a tremendous power to it. Yeah, so I said speech in these times is not just our conversational speech, but it's also everything we do online, which more and more is most of it, right? So I've done all these studies that are showing that kids are completely, I won't go too far with this, but kids are losing their ability to relate socially in certain situations, like read facial cues, develop empathy. So much of our communication is happening in the virtual world. So when we make a study of our speech, it includes that. And that whole terrain lends itself, perhaps you've noticed, to quick, automatic, often not very nuanced speech, right? It kind of goes for what's most alarmist, what's most attention-getting, and it kind of engages some of our most kind of visceral responses at times. So to kind of, this is all really important territory. But the first thing to remember, I think, with wise speech is to really have some faith and confidence that with our words, with my words, with my communication, I can choose to contribute to the ending of suffering. By what I say, what I put in motion through my speech, that is extremely powerful. So as we start, I wanted to just feel the possibility of that, that with our speech, we can contribute to the ending of suffering with that intention. So I gave a talk on wise speech years ago. I remember we were in Sodo, so I can't even remember what year it was, but I talked a lot about working with the mind, or kind of getting a sense of where we were coming from when we talk about wise speech. And someone came up to me afterwards and said, "You're not really giving me any concrete tips about what to say to my difficult person, you know. You're basically telling me to work with my own mind, you know?" And I said, "Yeah, kind of. That's exactly what we're doing here. We are working with our own minds." So I will say that I think that this is a kind of a combination practice. I think on the deepest level, what we're doing is working with our own mind. And we can also gain some skill in the specifics of what we articulate and how. We can gain skill in that area. And unfortunately, like most things, that is trial and error. But we can gain some capacity in that area. But speech does arise out of this whole inner climate. You know, I love words. I really am a lover of language and words, and can get very intent on specific words and what they mean. But they mean different things for all of us. You know, I can say one word like diversity, you know, and it can mean different things, have different connotations and associations for everybody. So much of it comes, speech's power comes from the mind and the inner climate of the speaker. Right? So how else could it be? Of course, it's that way. So Christina Feldman says, our words, I love this quote, I've used it a lot, you may have heard it. She says, our words are our thoughts with wings. We open our mouths and our minds fly out. Yeah. So we take great care, both with how we tend the soil of our inner climate, how we tend and understand our own hearts and minds, and what we set in motion in the world. Right? Both of those are powerful. So what I'd like to just touch on tonight are three different things. And the Buddha's teachings on why speech are very practical. They're extremely practical. And so I've always appreciated this teaching. The living of them, living them out, is another matter. But I thought what I could do is kind of divide these reflections into three categories. And the first are kind of guardrails for our speech. And I think of these as kind of, they keep us in somewhat safe territory, and somewhat like the precepts, if we flag these areas where we tend to kind of go off the rails, then it's more likely that in the heat of the moment, we will remember these guardrails. And they, oh, okay, and we'll be able to feel them when we're coming up against them. So they kind of keep us from veering too far into speech that's harmful. Yeah, so they're wonderful things about guardrails. And when we are in balance, when our inner climate is attuned and aligned and safe and supportive, we may not need them. We may notice a lot more kind of creative, attuned, naturally wise speech, but guardrails are certainly helpful when we're shaky and wobbly and uncertain. So the Buddha encouraged us to abstain from, or to just watch that our speech, watch when we notice that our speech is untrue, when it's divisive, when it's harsh, or when it's idle, like idle chatter. Right? That's the phrase, idle chatter. So when it's untrue, when it's divisive, when it's harsh, or when it's just idle chatter. So perhaps when you hear this list, you think, the news and the media, is there anything else? Is it almost all that? Not all of it, not all of it. But it is so tempting. The things that grab and draw our attention mostly fall into these categories. Untrue or embellished, exaggerated, shaded in some way, divisive. So it's meant to kind of incite or division or a strong feeling of passion, harsh and idle. So these are kind of our guardrails when we can notice that speech is going into these areas. We can deliberately refrain. So again, remembering the intent, the deepest intent is that our speech not create further suffering in a world that is on fire. So this is a powerful action. So abstaining from saying what you clearly know is not true. So the Buddha said, if you know something not to be true, don't say it is true. If you know something is true, don't say it isn't true. It's extremely basic, but not basic, right? So kind of speak as clearly and truthfully as you can without exaggerating, shading, spinning. And when we notice this tendency, which we all have for the sake of the story or another person's response, or to kind of evade some kind of unpleasantness, we'll notice the embellishing, the exaggerating, the spinning, the shading. We can pause in that moment and really ask, what am I wanting in this moment? Yeah. So that's the guardrail. What am I wanting in this moment? It's not, we're just aware of that moment in which our wanting has overtaken and of our deepest intention. No big deal. Can get back on course. So abstaining from what's untrue and divisive is speech that is deliberately gossiping or slanderous. So this will always arise out of a mind of aversion, right? And it's meant to diminish another. And we can feel that in our own speech. There may be a brief moment of satisfaction or superiority, but we'll be able to feel the reverberation from that. Yeah. That intent to divide or pit one person against each other. The next is harsh speech. So this is abusive speech, deliberately hurtful, and sarcastic is in there as well. So this is speech that has an edge to it, right? And we can just notice if there are habit patterns in our own speech. We may not even have malintent, but our speech patterns may have this kind of edge to them. So I know I come from a long line in my family of sarcastic people. Yeah, and this was just called humor in my family of origin. So it took some discerning to recognize, not everybody finds this funny, right? This is actually potentially really harmful. So to examine or to flag some of these habit patterns as guardrails. And the last of these is idle chatter. Right? And I think all of these are kind of obvious on some level, but they each have some nuance. Right? So, often this can be a very gendered kind of criticism, in which often it's women are criticized for being too chatty. And as I've explored this for myself, a lot of our, what seems like chatting is a way of really forming connections and friendliness. So we have to kind of look, is this kind of distracting us from our deeper aims and intentions? Or is this really contributing to friendship and cohesion, harmony? Yeah, so I think chatting can definitely do both. If it's distracting us, we'll notice that it's kind of draining our energy. We'll get cloudy, we'll get confused, we'll get distracted, we'll kind of forget the plot. So to notice this, and to mention also that none of these things are mortal sins, right? I hope you feel that these are not evidence of an evil in someone, right? These are simply where our speech start to go off the rails towards harm. So if we can approach that with a sense of humor, and it will go a long way, rather than as some proof of our inherent badness. All right. So this is these I think of as kind of our guardrails, and there are countless examples of these in everyday life. I don't want to spend too much time on it because we're inundated with examples of this kind of speech, right? Because these are so loud and draw our attention in such a regular, ongoing way. So we can ask ourselves too, when we feel ourselves getting drawn into this kind of divisive, harsh speech, what if we refuse to bite on that? Yeah. What if we more and more stay engaged, stay in conversation, but refuse to bite? So again, a practice, not so easy to do. Okay, so the second aspect is, what are our commitments around speech? So those are the guardrails that we can be aware of when we're veering away from our intention out of habit. But what are we committed to in terms of speech? And this arises so much out of wise intention. So again, not just an intention to refrain from what's harmful, but also a kind and compassionate intention, generous intention. So what kind of speech are we committed to? So the Buddha's suggestions around this, and kind of the framework, the sort of basic framework that shows up in the early teachings, is speech that is true, useful, timely, and arises out of a heart of goodwill. Right? So this is the kind of framework: true, useful, timely, spoken or arising out of a heart of goodwill. And as I was reflecting on it in preparation for this talk, I was realizing it's almost an acronym. I've been repeating this to myself for years: true, useful, timely, heart of goodwill. But it almost spells out truth. Yeah, so I'm going to just add one, and then it may be easier to remember or to refer back to. So the kind of speech that we can commit to and really get wholeheartedly behind is speech that is true. So it's clear. It's true. It's rooted. This is what I'm adding. This is the R, okay? It's rooted, which means it's rooted in our own integrity and dignity as a human being, in the musculature of our body, so that when we speak it, it has some authenticity to it. It has some sincerity. It feels connected. Because we can check all of these boxes. It can be true, it can be useful, it can be timely, it can be kind. But if it is not rooted in our own experience, it will not have a lot of power. All right. We know this, we've felt this. And this again is a deep practice. Yeah. So I think this can be kind of a shorthand test for our speech. But in a, I think it can be in a, in an encouraging way. What I'm going to encourage is that if our speech is in this terrain, if it is true, if it is rooted, if we sense that it's going to be beneficial, if it's spoken at the right time, if it's spoken from kindness, then it is imperative that we go for it, that we speak it wholeheartedly. Okay, so this all depends on a lot of discernment, inner discernment, and wise and deep listening. And so we can't really consider how we might have wise speech without wise listening. It just doesn't work. So many of you are familiar with Insight Dialogue. This is a framework developed by Gregory Kramer, and there have been teachers, several teachers here who've come over the last few years. And these are the last two guidelines, listen deeply and speak the truth. And they're always paired, right? So we simply can't know what's true, useful, and timely if we haven't listened first, inwardly and also outwardly. So we have to be able to discern what's true in order to speak it. So, as always, I think questions are more helpful often than commands. So we can ask regularly as we're interacting in the world, as we're writing, as we're engaging in various forms of media. What is true right now? What is true right now? Is this going in a helpful direction? So here's the useful part. Is this going in a helpful direction? Or what is needed? What is needed right now? So often we lose touch with these questions when we are in the heat of the moment in various circumstances. So what is needed right now? What is the state of my heart and mind right now? When I first started practicing with wise speech, I think the first time I heard this teaching was when I was leaving retreat and had a very long time of sort of steeping in this receptive listening. So had a lot of, felt like a lot of sensitivity to these categories, but not a lot of practice discerning and speaking them in the heat of the moment. So my first impulse in hearing this, these guidelines or these commitments was, well, if it has to be true, useful, timely, and in the heart of good, well, I'm never going to say anything ever again. Like, that's it. That's it. Nothing will pass that test. You know? So why say anything? So I think we have to be very careful that we don't set up an unrealistic ideal for ourselves and defeat ourselves before we've started. But to take maybe one of these categories and go deeply into it, find something that feels kind of juicy for you and explore it. But for the, after we ask the questions, for the truthful part, it is so powerful often in conversation when we don't know what to say, when we're confused or bewildered or unsure, we don't know how to relate, to just say one true thing. Just say one true thing. In some of my groups, I have people do this right after our sit, when the mind is receptive and open and attuned generally, to just say one true thing. Yeah. So it doesn't need to be true for all time, but it can be kind of an unapologetic noticing. Yeah. So it's hard right now. This is difficult. Yeah. There is anxiety present. Yeah. I'm noticing anxiety. Yeah. That didn't go the way that I wanted it to. Yeah. It's amazing what that will do. One true thing. And this is not dissimilar from the noting practice that we do when we're sitting silently. We can overdo it with the noting. Yeah, jealousy, jealousy, anger, anger. We can overdo it with the jealousy, but there is such a power in meeting the truth of the moment as best we can discern it and speaking it clearly. That is very powerful, especially when it's rooted, like I mentioned. Okay, so saying one true thing, I'm afraid. Yeah. This hurts. This really happened. Yeah. If this policy passes, people are going to die. Yeah. Those are all facts. Those are all truths. And the Buddha said, if you know something is true and beneficial, and it is going to upset someone or be inconvenient, uncomfortable, say it anyway. Just pick your time, yeah, and make sure your heart is aligned, right? So he never said to swallow the truth because it's going to upset somebody, you know, it's going to be uncomfortable or disagreeable. He said, our speech will be disagreeable at times. So pick the right time and align your heart. Okay, so this takes tremendous courage to be able to do this, and it takes knowing our own minds very well. So Stephen Batchelor said, every true ethical choice requires risk. Yeah, requires risk. So Marshall Rosenberg, who many of you know, came up with nonviolent communication, this wonderful tool. It's often in many places gets intersects with Dharma practice. I've studied it a bit, but most powerful was attending a training with Marshall Rosenberg. It was here in South Seattle many years ago, before he died, and I can't remember any of the context of what was happening, but he was present and facilitating a conversation between two people who had been violent with each other. They were extremely angry and had had this history of violence, and he was present with them and trying to facilitate a conversation. And moving on from true and useful, but with a heart of goodwill and rooted, watching his posture with these two people was so impactful because he stayed completely humble. And, you know, sometimes if we're armed for a fight in a conversation, you'll be able to feel your chest and your chin are almost out, right? You're braced, you're defended. But he was up there completely at ease, rooted, but soft, and completely reaffirming again and again of the intention for goodwill for both of them over and over and over again. And the audience got fidgety. They're like, this is never going to work. Nothing is going to happen here. And the crux of his whole training is to try to see beyond the harsh and divisive language for the pain of unmet needs, to connect with the human being and not forget or give up on the human being underneath the behavior, to stay rooted in that, trusting of that. And he has said over and over again, despite what my mind is always telling me, I know that peace is possible. If I continue to affirm this, I know that peace is possible. So watching him embody that was incredibly, incredibly moving for me, inspiring. Having the patience and the humility to continue to remember those commitments when all looks lost. Yeah. Okay. So we can catch ourselves in the moment. When there is something that we know is true and useful, and when we know that is true and useful, oftentimes we'll feel compelled to share with other people our good advice. Yeah. Because if anything like me, it comes to you as sort of a creative inspiration. Oh, I know what this person needs. I know it would be helpful. Yeah. It's true. It may be true. It may be useful. It may come from a compassionate place. But the person may have absolutely no interest in hearing it. So if we can learn to wait and to wait for the right time, to wait for openings in this case, yeah. In this case, to wait for openings, that more often than not, people are craving and seeking our full-bodied, compassionate presence prior to our advice. Yeah. Have you noticed? People are wanting that listening, that feeling of being understood more than our advice. So, true, rooted, useful, timely, the heart of goodwill. Yeah. So we can ask, what is in my own heart? Can I remember the heart of another? Can I remember our shared humanity when I'm speaking, that we are all in this together, that we share the same sensitivity to joy and sorrow, gain and loss? So that is the heart of goodwill. So when we commit to this, it is incredibly powerful, and it can take us through a lot of discomfort and challenge in speaking. We can continue to fall back on these commitments to stay sensitive to our impact, which is the listening. We can listen for our impact. What may feel very helpful in the down on the ground, nitty-gritty reality, if we're truly listening, we may notice that we are not being helpful in the moment. So to have the humility to notice this and redirect. Again, this doesn't mean that it won't be uncomfortable or unpleasant, but we'll be able to more and more discern the difference between an unpleasantness or a discomfort that is the direct result of me causing harm, contributing to harm, or simply the result of me not doing the usual thing, right? Me not doing the usual thing which often a speech pattern of mine I've worked on a lot is one of kind of deference, or telling somebody, you know, trying to comfort or console, but also can flip into telling the other person what they want to hear so that I won't have to feel uncomfortable. I won't have to feel as though I'm upsetting them, right? So this is classic female conditioning. Yeah, it is unsafe if you are displeased. Yeah. So we have to stand at times in the fire of that and discern that, what's helpful and appropriate in those situations. What is the discomfort that comes from habit? And what is the discomfort that comes from forging new territory? Okay, so this is what gives rise to courage. That's what I wanted to end with tonight. So I talked about guardrails. I talked about commitments. And it's really important, I think, to also talk about courageous speech. So, and to be on the lookout for wise and courageous speech, and to really notice it and take it in when we encounter it. So I mentioned Marshall Rosenberg. I have five other examples here that I'm not going to get to. But one another that came to mind, because so much of our speech now is images. Yeah. So remembering the powerful example of Darnella Frazier, many of you might know, is the 17-year-old who filmed the murder of George Floyd. Stood there with her camera and filmed the truth of that moment, and posted it. And that had life-changing reverberations for her and for all of us worldwide. But in speaking about it afterwards, she said, I filmed the truth of that moment, because that, in seeing that act of violence, that I saw my father, I saw my brother, I saw my cousins, yeah, that shared heart. So our images and our willingness to stay close to the reality of what is actually happening is powerful. Yeah. Another powerful example for me these days is Ocean Vuong. Any of you may know him. Just an absolute exquisite writer. Vietnamese American writer. And he speaks about the power of language to create the worlds that we inhabit. And he's a novelist. And if you have the opportunity to listen to an interview with him, as far as I can tell, his speech is all heart. Is completely transparent. There's no pretense in it at all. It feels completely rooted in the depths of his own experience. Speaking of very difficult realities, very difficult realities in terms of oppression, and not shying away at all from them and feeling the impact of them. Speaking to that impact. And he's also now a professor, can't remember which university, but he teaches creative writing. And not incidentally, he's the one who inspired Joseph Goldstein to start writing poetry. So a little closer to home. But he says, We often tell students that the future is in their hands. But I think what's more true is that the future is in our mouths. The future is in our mouths. It is in the way we speak. It is in what we choose to speak. It is in the worlds that we create when we speak. And our speech is so powerful. It does have that capacity to create, contribute to the kind of world we want to live in. Yeah. So the future perhaps is in our mouths. So certainly we want our speech to refrain from harm, but especially now, if it is to be compassionate, it will also need to be clear, to be connected, to be creative. And I could think of three other C's, but I'll stop. And if we do discern that our speech is these things, you know, it is in alignment, then as best we're able, it is imperative that we speak it. Yeah. We need to speak it fully, courageously, honestly, without holding back. Yeah. That is wise speech. Generous speech, courageous speech. So Joanna Macy, I'll just end with this quote, another of our revered elders in this tradition, who's a great inspiration to many of us, speaks out, has spoken out for decades on environmental issues from a Buddhist lens. And many of you might know she's on hospice right now, so we can send her our good wishes. Apparently, it sounds like her spirit is strong. But she, one of my favorite quotes of hers is, "If the world is to be healed through human efforts, if the world is to be healed through human efforts, I am convinced it will be by ordinary people, people whose love for this life is even greater than their fear." So in the spirit of courageous, wise speech, I am convinced that this will be by ordinary people, people whose love for this life is even greater than their fear. So why don't we just sit quietly for a moment? So appreciate all of your attention tonight. I know that was a lot. Towards the beginning of the month, hopefully our talks are more of kind of overviews the topic, and then we can get into the specifics throughout the month. So I'd love to hear any of your own comments, reflections, questions around this. Jackie, is your hand up, or are you modeling for people what to do?
No, my hand's up. No. I'm asking for someone who put a question in the chat. This person wants to know, what are your thoughts on responding to unwise speech when someone is using hateful speech towards you? How do you respond in a manner that can communicate your intent to protect yourself, and where the boundary for that is versus causing harm back?
Yeah, great question. And the Buddha did speak to that also. He said, people, just like we can go over this list of what we're committed to and what we're refraining from, people will speak to us in all kinds of ways. People speak to us in ways that are harsh or not harsh, kind or unkind, agreeable or disagreeable, you know, all of that. We will be the recipients of that. We can't control often. We can't control how people are coming at us with our speech. what we do have influence over is how we kind of take care of ourselves in that moment, and how we how and when we choose to respond. Right. So if something very, what we're perceiving as very harmful is coming at us in the moment, we can notice how we're being affected. Sometimes something can be coming at us, and if we are in a clear, connected, compassionate place, often it doesn't have, it doesn't stick in the same way. We can see clearly that that is coming from the other person, that it's not personal to us, that it's they are showing us their suffering. Right? It's a helpful thing to keep in mind. That we can take a pause and come back perhaps a bit later if we are triggered with a more helpful response. If we're not triggered in the moment, chances are we'll more easily have access to a clear and kind response, creative response. All right. If there's something that's been activated in us, we'll often need a deliberate pause, often a bit of space, turning away from what's being activated, and then reminding ourselves. Yeah? We might have to deliberately remind ourselves, okay, in this moment, I am safe, I am here, and remember our deepest intention. So the Buddha said, if somebody gives you a gift, yeah, do you have to accept it? Yeah? Someone hands you a gift. Do you have to accept it? And this was in a conversation, and the person who was responding said no. So if someone comes at you with anger, harshness, divisiveness, is it yours? Do you have to accept it? The answer is no, but it's tricky. There is the moment where it's very tricky, because we may see that it is kind of arising in the other person, but something in us is hooked by it, right? We've somehow gotten snagged or hooked, identified, and so all of our defensive mechanisms are coming to the fore. So we have to know what's happening, be able to know what's useful. And in that moment, when we're flooded, a useful response is highly unlikely. We just have to know that and remember that again and again and again. Yeah? Is this, yes. So, but it's so helpful that when these things are coming out of nowhere, seemingly nowhere, to recognize that often this is someone else is showing us their suffering. I can feel whether I'm snagged or not, whether I need a pause or not. And if we can't choose our own response, then it means we're not in control in that moment. Yeah.
In the Sunday team that runs the Sunday sits, we had a conversation about wise speech, and somebody brought up what I think is really an important piece, which is when we've said something and then you pretty quickly know it wasn't really skillful, it wasn't what you wanted to do, we're not stuck forever with it. We can stop and say, wow, you know, I didn't like the way that just came out. May I rephrase it? Or I need some time to think about it. I think it came across harshly, and that's not where I'm coming from. Or just there are opportunities, because like you said, it's hard to be on all the time with it, because there's so much happening and there's such a a request for quick responses. And so then we respond quickly and sometimes not so skillfully. So I really appreciated that idea that you could just stop and say, well, I'm not so happy with how I just responded to you. Can I take a minute? Or are you going to be here at the end of this? Could we talk later? Or just, you know, owning that you're not so happy with what you just said.
Yeah, I think that's really important. It's like repair on the spot. Yeah, and it takes a lot of attunement to stay aware both of the reverberation that we feel when we're off the mark a bit, and often when we're sensitive to the impact of another, when we may have been had a very skillful intention, but we notice it didn't land at all in the way that we thought it would. So there's another place where to be able to name that in the moment with clarity and directness and kindness is so, it's so skillful. Yeah, to be able to do. It's kind to ourselves, yes. Yeah, it's never usually just either or, if you've noticed. It's very rarely either or. So, yeah, that's kind of a delusion that we're separate. Yes, thank you. Thanks for that, Susie. Yeah.
Yeah, your comment that there are times where you just cannot respond appropriately, wisely or kindly, that wise silence is part of wise silence. Silence is speech, not saying.
Absolutely.
When you can't speak, then we can have wise silence.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And we can have a wise silence that is still present, right? So we haven't kind of for those of us who like withdrawing, we haven't like withdrawn. You know, we may withdraw to take an intentional pause, yes, but we can also, there can be silences that are, when we're kind of still judgmental, our mouths aren't open, but we're still going through. So we can stay engaged, but without vocalizing all of that. Yes, thank you for mentioning that. Yeah, we're still communicating when we're silent. Yeah.
Hi.
Hi.
So when I find myself in situations where I might have a hard time with good speech is where I feel like I'm in a scenario where I am backed into a corner or where I'm being oppressed somehow. You know, I have a story in my head that the person or the situation I'm dealing with is more like ill-willed than probably is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And it can often be really hard to get out of that mindset. And that's often when I know how good speech might look, but it feels almost impossible to get there and not speak from the place of like fight or flight or hurt and wanting to fight back.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering what you have to say about that.
Thanks for being willing to articulate that. And one of my suggestions for this week was going to be to make a study of our speech and to make a study of particularly those places where it feels really difficult to find a skillful response. And it's going to be in those places where we feel most activated, where it's hard to We may be able to know what we should say, but not be able to access that kind of rooted part of it. So I don't think there's any problem with saying, I don't think I can respond skillfully right now. This is like the naming the one true thing. So it's the hardest thing to do, and I'm not sure about like situation and whether this is like a close relationship or someone you don't know, but could say, I'm feeling activated and defensive right now. So I need to take a pause and kind of reconnect. Yeah. Or whatever you're noticing about your internal experience. You'll say, it feels challenging to stay present with this right now. Yeah. I'm feeling hurt.
Thank you.
I'm feeling unsure. So people can't really argue with that. There's nothing. So often we need to err on the side of being with that. That feels to me like more of the realm of listening a lot longer. Yeah. We're so often almost preoccupied with how do I get the words right? How do I communicate it exactly right? How do I get, but if we look underneath that, it's just wanting the other person to be different, to do something. We're wanting something in that situation that's not happening. Yeah. So does that speak to it a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah. Great. Thank you. All right. We're close to needing to stop. Maybe one more. Now there's a lot with this topic. Yeah, please.
I find whether it's, I'm driving, somebody honks at me and I think they shouldn't have, or somebody says something directly to me that I think is hurtful. And if I move on from that situation, there's a lot going on. I've been triggered and now it's all going in my head, all the things, and I realize the only way to get out of that is to see how bad I feel from all of that stuff going on in my head that's just not helpful.
Yeah. And that's a wonderful way out, actually. So that's feeling the dukkha. We're feeling the dukkha of the mind state. Yeah. Like how much churning goes into all of our mind states that give rise to unwise speech. They're highly unpleasant. Yeah. So it's a wonderful, it's not comfortable, but it's so helpful because that's how we learn. It's like, oh, this like making my case or being so aversive, like fixating on the other person's flaws or developing my argument or trying to be right or regretting I didn't say that perfect thing. All of that is such a state of suffering. So to feel this is unpleasant, this is dukkha. That actually helps us disentangle from that habit. So that's wonderful. Yeah, very helpful. All right. So thank you, everybody. Really encourage you to take this on, again, not as a lofty ideal, but really get into the nitty gritty of it. Yeah. What are your habits? Where do you, I love that you said kind of cornered. Where do we feel cornered? Like we don't have choice. And, where are guardrails helpful? What guardrails tend to be helpful for you? Please don't forget to notice when you're actually noticing incidences of wise speech, people speaking courageously, clearly, kindly, it's so important to know that that also exists. So you can notice that too.